It's my great pleasure to be here with you, and thank you for that very kind introduction. So why am I here? Well, I'm a foodie, and I enjoy cooking, and I learned a long time ago that if I'm setting out to bake bread and I forget the salt, I may have a lovely loaf at the end of my baking experience, but it's not going to be very enjoyable, and it's not going to taste very good. And I've realized through all of my work, and I've sort of transitioned to where I am now. I was a nurse for 14 years before I went to law school. I ran the organ donor program in the state of Georgia. I was the managing attorney of an AIDS legal project. And through this continuum, I realized that we needed to expand our interdisciplinary team in caring for patients to be better able to address the challenges that our patients face. So what I'm going to do today is, you know, describe medical legal partnership for you, explain how it can promote patient-centered care, describe how medical legal partnership can lead to improved quality and compliance and patient safety, and describe how medical legal partnership impacts education of both current and future professionals and practitioners. So I'm sure this crowd is all very familiar with the social determinants of health. You know, they're the conditions that we are born into, live, work, play, and age and die within. And everyone is sort of getting on the bandwagon about this. The American Academy of Pediatrics put out a policy statement in the last 2 months saying that we needed to start paying attention to social determinants. The Beyond Flexner conference that was held earlier this week in Miami, the whole theme of that conference was about social determinants, doing something to increase social justice. And for me, in what I do, we're talking about doing something about poverty in our cities and across the country. For the longest time, I referred to my work as addressing disparities, until one night several years ago when I went to a presentation by Sir Michael Marmot, one of my heroes, and he corrected me and expanded my vision that I should be thinking about equity because it's much broader based and collaborative. And so since then, I've been looking at what I do and educating people that I come in contact with through the lens of health equity. The World Health Organization tells us that, yes, access to care, particularly in acute illness stages, is extremely important. However, in the long run, if we were to make greater contributions in the area of social supports, we might in fact have better overall, longer standing, more predictable outcomes. The CDC uses this pyramid, and they've got it for all kinds of diseases, including STDs. The uniform factor throughout all of them is the base. And we can have a bigger impact if we address those social economic factors that affect every single patient population, including the one that brought you all here to Atlanta for this conference. And again, the theme is we need to do something about poverty in America. We need to do something about housing. We need to improve educational outcomes. And that takes commitment, and it takes funding, and it takes policy change. On the population health side, I'm sure you're all familiar with this, but when we look in the middle here on social and economic factors, contributing 40% towards mortality and morbidity and health outcomes, things like education, employment, income, or the lack of it, family and social supports, and community safety are all huge contributors to either having positive health outcomes or not so much. Poverty in the United States, overall, it's 14.8. In the Southeast, it's significantly higher. The child rate of poverty is 21.1 nationwide, and here it's running around 23.4% in Georgia, and even higher in places like Macon, for instance, that has a population of 260,000 people. The African American rate is higher still, and the Hispanic rate is something that we need to do something about. Social determinants. 14% of our population is hungry. Of those eligible to receive SNAP benefits, which is supplemental nutritional assistance, only 79% actually get those benefits. Why? Because we erect barriers that make it so difficult for individuals and families to access this benefit. 57 out of 100 people have access to affordable, available housing, particularly in cities, and of course I'm familiar with Atlanta. The dearth of decent affordable housing is appalling, and bad housing exacerbates illness. 23.2% of the population of people under 65 and below 138% of poverty in 2014 didn't have health insurance, and so accessing care, any kind of care, was a challenge. Education. To me, education is the path up and out of poverty, and for many, the path up and out of trouble. The high school graduation rate nationwide is 81%. It's lower in the South, and it's lower in the state of Georgia. The wage gap continues, and for people living in poverty, many of those families are single female heads of household, and so that gap is significant. And the unemployment insurance coverage rate is very, very low also nationwide. So looking at what we do spend our money on, we're very, very good at spending money as a percentage of our GDP on healthcare. And in fact, we by more than 1.5 times outstrip every other nation in the OECD, which is the Organization of Economic Cooperation. And other nations seem to accomplish healthcare without spending quite so much money on it. So what determines health? I enjoyed reading a book called The American Health Paradox by two authors, one of whom is Lauren Taylor, discussing this issue, and it resonated with me. Health is 20% of the healthcare that we're actually able to access. 20% is genetics and what we're born with and the hand that we are dealt. But 60% are those social, environmental, and behavioral issues, many of which were highlighted in that raconteur session, which I found very enjoyable, are actually what really affect health. In those same OECD nations, they invest more in the social aspects of health, much more so than the United States does. And as a result, we're spending 90 cents in social supports as opposed to $1 for healthcare. Europe is spending $2 on social supports, and they're experiencing better infant mortality statistics, fewer low birth weight babies, and overall better health and longevity. So there's a movement, I'm sure you're all aware of it. It's covered in the ACA, and many health policy think tanks are thinking about this. And in fact, in one of my classes, we're working on a project with a community partner about, can we do something about having some kind of a health in all policies policy in Georgia, where we look at every policy we make across all kinds of departments, education, transportation, human services, education, all of criminal justice, juvenile justice, with an eye on health, using a health-focused lens and evaluating those decisions we make in terms of health. So here's the joke. The lawyer walks into the hospital. When I first did this 14 years ago, there were several raised eyebrows. But I was invited because people realized that they needed to expand their team to more effectively address the issues that they were confronting. And the reason for this is the Legal Services Corporation that funds most of the civil legal services providers in this country estimate that over 50 million Americans need legal care to be healthy. And not only do they have one legal problem, but the families that we see have multiple legal problems. They may come in the door with one, but we've adopted a legal checkup where we go through the main kinds of issues that people living in poverty tend to experience and determine whether they're experiencing a problem with that area and whether we can assist in alleviating the problem. So in order to do something about that 50 million gap, we've got to change the paradigm. This is the sort of traditional healthcare model. The physician has, you know, treated the otitis media and everything seems to be fine. This old version totally ignores what's going on in the background and the environment in which this child here lives. And so we've got to have our care providers be aware that there's more than just the actual physical problem being presented that needs to be treated or the actual mental health problem. There's more to it than that. We also make it very, very tough. Childkind created this maze here, and it's really not an over-dramatization. And in the middle, you see parent and child, but it's the same for any population that's trying to access social supports here in the state of Georgia. There isn't a common portal. Barriers are met, and I would posit that those people who don't end up on food stamps because even though they're eligible, the main reason is that they hit a wall in trying to apply for it, or they felt disrespected in the process of applying, or they felt that whoever was providing the service wasn't culturally sensitive to them. And these are things that we can fix through public policy change. So what is a medical legal partnership? We in the biz say that it's a healthcare delivery model that integrates legal assistance as a vital component of medical care or healthcare. It serves all populations. Now, my descriptions to you are dealing with peds because my partner is a pediatric health system, but probably the very, very first medical legal partnership was the partnering of initial HIV/AIDS treatment centers with lawyers to address the discrimination issues and the housing problems and the employment problems that people with AIDS were experiencing. And so it works with any population, pregnant women, disease-specific individuals, the elderly, immigrants. Mine just happens to be children, and that's the lens that I look through. We work to improve population health through our systemic advocacy efforts and to manage utilization. This is particularly important now with new reimbursement models that are coming down through Medicare, Medicaid, and also private insurance as well. And for those institutions that have a medical legal partnership, it's a differentiator. They have something that other people don't have. It may provide a competitive edge. The bottom line, it's expanding the healthcare team to include all of those critical ingredients. So my medical legal partnership has been in place since 2004, and we have three institutional partners. One is Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. It is a 3-hospital, 17 community clinic, fully integrated clinical network here in Atlanta. They see over 380,000 unique patient visits every year, and over 53% of those are financially eligible for my services. That's a whopping number of kids. There's no way that I can assist that number every year. So in addition to direct services, we have to have some other tools in our bag. Our second partner is Georgia State University College of Law. This is the education change agent in our partnership. And the third is Atlanta Legal Aid. Atlanta Legal Aid has been a strong force for low-income people who need civil legal assistance for over 100 years, and it is a legal services funded entity. And in our partnership, we've got four components, four things that we do, and they're all of equal weight. Number one, we deliver what we call public health legal services, and that's the direct services of handling the legal problem, whatever that may be. And we handle over 600 cases every year. Systemic advocacy is another component. While we can handle the legal problems patient-client each, perhaps a more broad view, policy change would be effective, and so we engage in that work. Education. We want to change that paradigm, and we're doing it by educating the next generation through our programs at Georgia State in collaboration with Emory School of Medicine and Morehouse School of Medicine. And from the very beginning, we've had a robust research evaluation and scholarship component. So what is our particular vision? Well, we certainly in our community want to improve access to healthcare services for children who are treated or could be treated at Children's. We want to improve their health outcomes. We want to engage in education of that next generation. And we want to use legal and policy advocacy to facilitate broad resolutions to the problems we face in our community. So I've got two little case studies for you. This is mold. This is mold in a Section 8 house in Atlanta in August. This mold sent a 10-year-old girl to the emergency department twice, and on the third trip, she went by ambulance at 3 o'clock in the morning and spent 4 days in the ICU at one of Children's Hospitals with status asthmaticus, which is not compatible with life if it's left untreated. And on all three of those visits, in the progress notes was the note by the provider, suspect noncompliance. This child had been an asthmatic for a long time and had follow-up care at Children's. But it wasn't until the provider referred the case to a social worker and said, you know, I'm worried about medical neglect, that the real story came out. The real story is that mom had actually really been trying to do everything she could. She complained to the landlord in writing. She complained to the housing authority to request a transfer of her certificate so she could live in a safer place. She called code enforcement, and she actually called the public health office in her county, and nobody did anything. The social worker, having been educated about our program and our collaboration, referred the case to me. And we were able to fix the problem. Sometimes being able to sign a letter ESQ can be a very valuable tool. And, you know, the housing authority realized right away when we had copies of medical records and a nicely pictured narrative of what had happened to this child that, yes, they better do something. And we followed this child for a number of years afterwards, and she didn't have any trips to the ED for several years. So we looked at our asthma population. You know, asthma is very common now, particularly in children. It is the number one diagnosis of kids admitted to Children's. They may have other problems, but they also have asthma. And we looked at, over a three-year period, 313 kids that had an asthma diagnosis to see what else was going on with them. And we realized that because of their asthma, they were missing an awful lot of school, and no one was doing anything about it. Of these kids, they missed over 4 years of school. It's pretty hard to learn if your seat is not in the chair. We were able to correct and ameliorate these situations. Some children needed special education plans. They needed homebound services so they could actually keep up and graduate. And with certain kinds of training and tutoring and whatnot, to the tune of over $500,000 in benefits to them. These are the kinds of legal problems we address. These are our big buckets. We do other things. We do employment-related issues and consumer problems as well. But housing conditions, particularly with kids, is a leading exacerbator of illness. Not just asthma, but sickle cell disease, kids who are immunocompromised for whatever reason. And even if the conditions are okay as far as mold and roaches and rats and that kind of thing, maybe it's in a terrifyingly unsafe neighborhood. And moving would allay a lot of stress. Disability is a huge thing for kids. Here in our state, it brings a better level of Medicaid. More providers are willing to take disability Medicaid. And disability Medicaid covers more kinds of treatments, therapies, and expensive drugs. Education, again, family law, huge stressor, huge stressor. It's amazing the kind of bad behavior that is played out over a bedside, and so we address those issues. And of course, in the health insurance range, Children's does a very good job of enrolling eligible children, but the problems come up when someone enrolled is being told that the treatment or whatever that their provider has said is medically necessary, Medicaid doesn't want to cover. So we fight about those kinds of things. And we've had to learn a lot of medicine over the years. You can see that asthma is our leader in developmental delay, but across the sort of scope of major illnesses here. The second case study I wanted to talk about with you is more of a policy piece. We have a statute here that defines what venereal diseases are, and it doesn't include HIV. Our statute allows teens who have a disease that's on the list in our code not to have parental consent for testing. And we were seeing an awful lot of kids coming through the emergency department being referred to us who were concerned, wanted to be tested for HIV, but were terrified of letting their parent know. And the hospital's position was, well, it's not on the list in the code, so there's nothing we can do about it. Through research and writing a nice little brief on the issue, we convinced the hospital, starting with the ethics committee, that actually HIV should be on that list. It isn't, because advocates in our community still are concerned about opening up that statute or anything having to do with HIV disease. And that it should be treated that way so that the child could be tested. And they saw the wisdom of that and changed the hospital policy. Just one example of systemic work. So what's in it for the healthcare partner? You. Well, looking at our populations of kids who were on Medicaid, but Medicaid didn't want to pay for whatever the service was, by fighting with the Medicaid agency, we were able to cost avoid for the hospital $640,000 worth of care. If we hadn't been able to achieve this, their charity dollars would have been used for this. And personally, I think if there's a funding stream available, it should be used as opposed to charity dollars. And this wouldn't have happened but for our intervention on behalf of those children. In our effort to change that paradigm and educate the next generation, one example I'm going to share with you is a class that we've had with Morehouse School of Medicine for many years. We started the class, we have four joint sessions of our law students with third-year medical students at Morehouse, where we talk about medical legal partnership. We have role plays and case studies and small group work involving the care continuum from birth to death in patients. We identify legal, medical, and ethical issues, and we spend a good amount of time, a whole class, in fact, on end-of-life issues, the legal, medical, and ethical issues in that whole category of care. And after we've been teaching it for a few years, we decided maybe we could do a little research study on this. And so we created our own homegrown survey, which the results of which are going to be published in Academic Medicine in the, soon on our research. Now, just to set the table a bit, Morehouse is a historically black college and university. And on the very first day, students come into medical school in M1, and the process of educating them about equity, about the social determinants of health, begins. So they are already pretty aware before we get to see them in their third year of medical school. And so this is showing their likeliness to screen. Before we started our lecture series, we gave the survey before we ever opened our mouths, and then at the end of the fourth survey, at the conclusion of the whole curriculum, how they felt about their likeliness to screen patients for social or legal issues. And statistically across all, we saw improvement. And someone said to me at one point, well, you must be disappointed that the bars in gray weren't even more significant. And I had to say, yeah, but they start. It's part of their curriculum. It's part of their core mission that's on everything they do about addressing social determinants. So even with that group, we were able to make a difference. And we also did a comparison of their likeliness to actually refer a patient to a legal resource if they had one available, and their opinion as to whether having a legal representative on the healthcare team would be helpful to them. So our study conclusions are that this interprofessional education experience increased awareness of how legal problems affect health, increases the likelihood of screening for legal problems, and increases the likelihood that they would actually refer. One of our main focuses in our education is when physicians or any provider is doing a history and physical, that they actually incorporate some trigger social questions about housing, about income, about insurance. Most providers have no clue as to what insurance people are covered by. To ask, and then if they get a positive test, then they can refer to an organization such as ours. Based on our small sample with our third year medical student class, we were invited to join a three-year, three-site study to look at actually proving that medical legal partnership interventions are useful. And so we have three target groups that we're looking at, patients and community, cost savings for institutions like hospitals or clinics, and student, resident, and fellow education, and actually changing their level of awareness and ability to actually screen. More about what might be available to you is, you know, reducing barriers to discharge. This has become a very important issue as far as reimbursement is concerned for healthcare entities. Reducing length of stay, decreasing readmission, increasing the ability to actually follow the care plan, whatever that may be. We provide a differentiator for children's. We have flown children's flag across this country and internationally talking about the work that we do. We contribute to a more enduring and complete relationship between the patient and the health system and the provider. We are able to help residents, and particularly achieve some of their core competencies that they need to successfully complete their residency in pediatrics. And of course, that's true in any kind of residency program. It's not just limited to pediatrics. So we think we are of value, and we are also contributing to quality improvement, the ability to not stay in the hospital beyond what is necessary, training everybody that discharge planning begins at, if not before, admission, and so that problems can be identified early and addressed early, and sort of systematically chipping away at poverty in our community in order to change outcomes and improve public policy. If you're interested in more information about this, we have a National Center for Medical Legal Partnership. It's housed at GW. And they have toolkits, speakers. We're a member of this organization, and it's been exceedingly helpful to us. Now there are variations on a theme, but roughly 360 medical legal partnerships across the country. Every day, more medical schools, law programs, and pro bono partners are getting involved. If you're interested in some of the research we've done in our program evaluations, we have our own website with information. And of course, I'm always available to answer any questions that anyone might have. And so with that, I thank you very much for your attention. And if anyone has any questions, I'm happy to try and address them.
So we have time for a few questions before we get to the final session of the conference. If people could come to the mic.
Thank you very much for the presentation. We just had a presentation about congenital syphilis, and I was just wondering, given you're interested in young people, what's your approach to addressing system failure in congenital syphilis cases?
Well, that's interesting. I guess it would depend on what kind of legal issues that child may be experiencing. I would imagine that disability might be one of them, right?
Well, yeah, failure to screen the mom, failure to administer treatment to the
right.
mom.
Well, and those are all wonderful public policy issues that I'm very interested in, actually. And so my stage actually is a state stage, but we could make differences about that here. And there are legislators, I think, who would be interested in doing that.
Thank you.
Question over here.
Yes.
That was great. I applaud the work that you're doing. I was wondering if it's getting easier or harder.
I'm sorry?
The work that you're doing, you're making such great progress and so forth, but I was wondering if your task is becoming harder or easier.
That's an interesting question. I think on some level I would think after 14 years I wouldn't have to keep reminding people that I exist, but I find that I have to do that on a regular basis. The challenge of policy change, particularly in our state here, is unrelenting. But I'm a patient woman. I've been in this for the long haul. And I guess I'll be doing it until I'm not vertical anymore.
With that note, I think we were going to close the session. That's a fantastic comment. And we thank you very much. And can we call you Esquire?